Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here, as is often the case, with Russ Chianelli. And today we have a guest who's in the area of neuroscience. And I just noticed the other day that he's going to be talking at our institution. And in the title of his talk was sort of temptation. And I thought, my goodness, what a wonderful thing to talk about on the radio. So, Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Terry Robinson, and he's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Michigan. Welcome to Science Studio, Terry.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, we're looking forward to this, Terry, because I just the whole idea of temptation, and there's a possibility that we're genetically predisposed to be easily tempted or more difficultly tempted, we can get into that. But before we do, how did Terry Robinson become a scientist? What were those sort of moments when you were a young child or a young man that said, science is what I want to do?
Yeah, it's actually, I can point it to a particular time. It's certainly growing up, I actually never thought of going into science. No one in my family ever went to university. I'm the first person before or since has ever gone to university. I grew up in a very small town in northern Ontario, and you went and worked for Ontario Hydro. That's what you did. But
you didn't try out for hockey?
Well, you know, there were sports, but that's a different. You want competition? That's real competition to make it in that kind of a field. But after working for a living for a little while, I decided that wasn't the best thing, and so I got this idea of going to university, mainly to avoid having to work for a living. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and it wasn't until I was a third year undergraduate, and I was taking an undergraduate course at a small university in southern Alberta, University of Lethbridge. At the time was called physiological psychology. These days that would be called behavioral neuroscience. And the professor who was teaching it had just graduated, and it was the very first course he'd ever taught. And I thought, this stuff is pretty interesting. So I went up to him after class one day and asked, well, you know, where do they do the kind of research that you're talking about, thinking he would say Toronto or Vancouver or something like that. And he just said, well, if you're interested, show up Friday, 8 o'clock, room such and such. I showed up. And I won't describe the procedures that we went through, but from that moment, I never left the lab.
You mean the procedures you inflicted on others is what you
exactly,
really mean, right?
Yeah.
You work with rats, mice,
that's
and all
right.
the normal.
I do preclinical basic research using primarily rats, mice, right. For the most part, yeah. But that was the moment that I knew what I wanted to do, and
let's go back. That was, let's say, 30, 40 years ago.
That was a long time ago.
What major strides? I mean, you've now been in there all your sort of life, and you've maintained your interest in the same area, in terms of neuroscience anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Big differences? Do we know an awful lot more today that we can say, well, we really know how to deal with people with this particular addiction, for example? Or we made much progress in that time.
In terms of our basic understanding of brain-behavior relations, which is what my field is, that is understanding how brain activity translates into behavior and psychological function, from when I was a graduate student to now, there's no comparison. I mean, even the technology, just think of the technologies. When I was a graduate student in terms of research on brain function in humans, you didn't have PET imaging, you didn't have fMRI, you didn't have any of the kinds of imaging techniques that allow you to look at human brain function. What you had at that time was basically, if you were looking for a brain lesion, for example, in a person, you had radiological techniques where you looked at deformed blood vessels to try to make a guess at where a tumor might be, for example. So the technology alone has advanced to such an extent, both in preclinical work and work on humans, that the knowledge that we have how brain functions to produce behavior and psychological function is just, you just have to look at the old textbooks. I mean, it's a completely different world.
And is that translated, therefore, into some therapeutic regimes where we can, really say, if you've got this particular issue to deal with, we know how to deal with it?
Well, of course, when it comes to human brain diseases, and you're really talking about neurological diseases or psychiatric diseases, they're probably the most complicated kinds of medical disorders you'll ever encounter. We certainly know tremendous amount more about what the underlying pathology is in things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, or even in major psychiatric diseases like schizophrenia, manic depressors. Has that translated yet into sort of ultimate cures? It hasn't. But you can sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel now, I think, for many of these kinds of diseases.
Yeah, that's something we work on with that understanding. Perhaps the right drugs will come along for Alzheimer's in particular.
Yeah, exactly.
For some of these things, how do you make the translation to rats? From humans to rats, I mean, how do you do that?
Of course, it depends what your question is. You know, mammalian brains in general have the same basic structure and function. And so even going from a rat to a cat to a monkey to a human, most of the brain systems that mediate the sort of core behavioral and psychological functions are pretty much the same. And so the classic example in neurological disease is Parkinson's, for example. I mean, rats have dopamine cells that project to a region called the striatum, and if those cells die or are destroyed with the neurotoxin, you get in the rat what is a Parkinson's syndrome. The system, those systems are really, you know, homologous to the exactly same systems you see in the human. Where things get a little bit more complicated in translation, of course, is when you start to talk about higher cognitive function, that is, functions mediated by a very elaborated neocortex. But still, at a basic level, mammalian brains have a common structure, common kinds of functions, and you can really tell a lot from studying the lower organisms as to what's going on in terms of brain function in humans.
I joked about hockey before, but I've always been a boxing fan and saw Cassius Clay back in the day. That now is Muhammad Ali, as we all know. And there's these terrible pictures in the magazines of him with his grandson. What kind of brain damage does a boxer get, or anybody that gets hit in the head, like they're arguing about high school kids today and so on?
You have a lot of sort of nonspecific trauma associated with any kind of blunt force injury. With Muhammad Ali in particular, what you have is damage to these dopamine cells. So Parkinson's disease, you can get the symptoms of Parkinson's disease through a variety of means. Most Parkinson's disease is what's called idiopathic, which means of unknown cause. However, I mean, in the old days when people used coal gas or manganese poisoning will kill those cells. There's environmental toxins that we know that are out there that will kill those cells. There was a famous example a number of years ago of an illicit drug, an opiate-like drug that was being synthesized that went onto the market for recreational use. But the guys that were synthesizing it made a little mistake, and they ended up with a drug called MPTP. And all of a sudden, a number of young people were presenting in emergency rooms that literally overnight developed dense Parkinson's disease. And if you give that neurotoxin to non-human animals, it'll also produce Parkinson's disease because it's a neurotoxin that kills dopamine cells.
And produce it very rapidly.
That's right. Oh, yeah, overnight.
Process.
Literally overnight.
Let's talk a little bit specifically then, Terry, about what your particular interests are. I mean, because neuroscience, you've already covered a whole range of topics within our first few minutes. What's your specific focus? What is it that you think you and your laboratory are really sort of making inroads into as your choice of target?
Okay, so for the last 25, 30 years, the focus of my research program, which has been funded by the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, which is one of the institutes of the National Institutes of Health, has focused on what you can think of as the long-term behavioral and neurobiological effects of exposure to a variety of drugs of abuse and the implications of these drug-induced changes in the brain for addiction. The drugs that we've focused on in my lab in particular are the psychostimulant drugs. So these are drugs like the amphetamines or cocaine, although we've done some work with opiate drugs like heroin or morphine as well. But the basic idea and what we've explored over the years is when you're exposed to these kinds of drugs repeatedly, in humans or non-human animals, these drugs change brain systems. And they change brain systems in a variety of ways and in very persistent ways. And so we early on in my research showed that animals that were exposed to drugs like amphetamine or cocaine, for example, either self-administering the drug or the experimenter giving them the drug, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 times, you could show that those drugs changed behavior.
You can map an addictive spot in the brain or something
like that? Well, it's not an addictive spot in the brain, but what you can show at a behavioral level is that the behavioral consequences of re-exposure to the drug, even after months or years of abstinence, are different. So as a consequence of having been exposed to drugs in the past, your response to drugs in the future are different. And one of the brain systems that's changed in a very, very persistent way is a brain system called the mesolimbic dopamine system. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter in the brain. And what dopamine is important for in the brain is mediating motivational kinds of processes. That is the extent to which we desire or want things. Now, of course, the brain system is not there to mediate the effects of drugs. It's there to mediate the effects of natural rewards, you know, food, water, sex. I mean, it's a brain system that motivates behavior in the pursuit of natural rewards in an adaptive way. But drugs tap into this dopamine system in inordinately powerful ways and can also change the system such that after exposure to drugs, this system becomes hypersensitive or sensitized. The phenomenon is called sensitization. And one consequence of that is that when you're exposed to drugs in the future, you get a bigger dopamine effect than you did if you hadn't been exposed to drugs in the past. And my colleague Kent Berridge and I have a theory of addiction that we call the incentive sensitization theory of addiction that suggests, sorry, at the core, that addiction is due in part due to sensitization of these dopamine systems. And so if you think about addiction, I mean, the core feature of addiction is that addicts tend to want drugs more and more and more and more, even though the drugs may be producing less and less pleasure.
So and, but then the other implication is if you can sort of, I don't want to say cure, but I'm not quite what the word is, if you can get your patient or the person, the subject, to be off of drugs for many, many years, but you can just have one future occasion of utilization which will go back almost to the beginning or, I mean, in terms of their dependency.
Yeah, so this is one of the critical clinical problems in addiction, of course, is relapse. That is, it's relatively easy to take people through detoxification regimens and get them off drugs for, you know, for fairly long periods of time even. And a lot of addicts spontaneously will stop using drugs for, you know, periods of time. The problem is that there's a very, very high prevalence of relapse.
Right.
And relapse in addicts tends to occur as a consequence of either re-exposure to a small amount of the drug itself, you know, that's called the priming effect, or encounter with cues that are associated with drugs, with contexts that are associated with drugs.
So people, for example.
People or places or street corners or your favorite bar.
Yeah.
All of those are, this is where the temptations come from. All these cues are temptations. And these temptations are acting on hypersensitive dopamine systems. And so in animals that have been sensitized to the drugs, when they encounter these cues, these temptations, if you will, they have an inordinate large effect in terms of motivating behavior to pursue the drugs again.
And so alcoholism, I mean, I know it's a different drug of choice, if you like, but I mean, the same thing, that the people who have been in Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, they scrupulously got to not take alcohol. Is it the same process that we're talking about, that, you know, one interaction with alcohol will send you back to an earlier position very easily?
Yeah, that's the idea. So one tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous is once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic.
Okay.
In our terminology, one reason that is that indeed the drug has really changed these brain systems in a very persistent way. And so you have to be on guard and resist these temptations, and it's not going to go away very, very soon. And Alcoholics Anonymous is about building support systems to help people avoid these kinds of temptations and teaching them that how powerful they can be in terms of creating these urges again.
You've got to resist the temptation to turn the radio off. You're listening to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Professor Terry Robinson from the University of Michigan, Professor of Psychology, Neuroscience. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Few emotions are more discussed, sung about, and central to a story than love and sex. They give rise to intense emotions, and scientists have asked for years which part of the brain they involve. Researchers pooled brain imaging data from 20 studies and mapped the zones that lit up as people viewed erotic images or pictures of their romantic partners. What emerged were two structures called the insula and the striatum.
Both facilitate feelings behind sex and love, and provide evidence that first comes lust before love can follow. When a person feels desire, it's the insula that brings it into consciousness.
Located in the cerebral cortex, the insula connects the limbic system, which is a primitive emotion area, to the cortex where higher thinking occurs. This way, we become aware of our feelings and attribute meaning to them.
Brain images also reveal that the back portion of the insula is triggered by desire, the front by romantic feelings, and the middle portion by someone they love and desire.
As this is happening, the striatum is also triggered. Located close to the insula, The striatum coordinates planning and executing pathways so that when a person is motivated, they act, for example, on the object of their love and desire.
The striatum also has reward pathways activated by sex and food, allowing a person to feel pleasure by these stimuli. Over time, as sexual pleasure with someone continues, the striatum's other function of conditioning rewards the action and paves the way for sexual desire to progress to love.
Drug addictions trigger the same pathways, proving what people have always felt, that love is addictive. We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries are shaping the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pennell, Russ Chinelli, and we're talking to Professor Terry Robinson from the University of Michigan, psychology and neuroscience specialist. I mean, we've been talking about addiction and the fact that once an addict, always an addict perhaps, because it just takes a very small stimulant to put you right back to square one, even if it's been many years. Russ, you had a question, I think.
I had a friend who went through Synanon, who was a heroin addict, and she became cured and became a worker, anti-drug worker and all that. But I remember her telling me, she said, when I have that desire and I don't have any heroin, it's like being at bottom of a 1,000-foot well and I can only see light at the top. Wouldn't it be better to legalize it and make it a medical problem?
Legalization is a very, very complicated issue that we would hope would be informed primarily by science, but as many political decisions, it often isn't. And I think you can make pretty cogent cases, depending on the drug, of course, for maybe not necessarily legalization, but certainly a lot of people talk about decriminalization. I mean, one statistic is something like 70% of the people in prisons these days are there for drug-related offenses. I think the evidence suggests that the kinds of strategies that have been pursued in the past have not been particularly effective in terms of solving the problem. And it's probably reasonable to start to think about other kinds of approaches that might be more tractable in solving this kind of a problem.
Okay, well, getting back to the science part of it, that there might be drugs that prevent the binding of the heroin, or there might be a vaccine, I even remember reading. What do you think about those things?
Well, this is, again, a controversial thing where you'll talk to 10 scientists and you'll get 10 different answers. There is certainly a large push to develop what would be called pharmacotherapeutic approaches to addiction. I'm one who's a bit of a skeptic when it comes to a magic bullet drug to treat something that psychologically is complicated addiction. And so there is, of course, an effort to develop a cocaine vaccine, for example, so that if you take cocaine, basically it gets bound up in the bloodstream and doesn't get to the brain. Some kinds of problems with that approach, it'll be very good at preventing the effect of cocaine, but one way to overcome that is simply take more cocaine, which could exacerbate the problem, or switch to amphetamine. These are complicated kinds of issues, and to deal with it in thinking that you're really going to develop a magic bullet kind of drug, I don't think is, in my personal opinion, feasible. So we have a magic bullet drug, for example, if you think for heroin. There's an antagonist. Heroin acts by acting on an opiate receptor called the mu opiate receptor. Naloxone is a drug that's treated for overdose for heroin.
Is in the brain?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
It binds to a receptor in the brain. Naloxone is a drug that binds to that receptor. Itself doesn't do anything, but it'll prevent heroin's action. So if you show up in the emergency room with a heroin overdose, you give a naloxone and immediately you will come out of
It's a competitive inhibitor.
It's an antagonist.
Receptor site.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so it gets in there but stays there.
Yeah.
So that there's no access for the heroin molecule.
Exactly. But we've known for a long, long time treating people with naloxone is not particularly effective in treating heroin addiction. So approaches just to prevent the action of the drug historically have not been very effective. And again, one of the reasons is that this is a really complex psychological as well as neurobiological problem. And addicts aren't stupid. If they're really addicts, they can find ways around many of these pharmacotherapeutic approaches. So I think pharmacotherapeutic approaches may be very important as an adjunct, but you have to get into treating the broader psychological problems.
So it begs the question, why is there an opiate receptor in the brain? What does it do in the absence of opiates
Sure.
Why is it there?
All drugs of abuse that influence behavior and psychological function are acting on brain systems, receptors, that mediate the effects of neurotransmitters that are endogenous to the brain, that are there not to mediate the effects of drugs, but to mediate normal behavioral and psychological processes. So I mentioned dopamine. Dopamine is a system in the brain that has receptors and so on. That's part of a system that's involved in mediating normal motivated behavior. Opiates in the brain are found in many, many parts of the brain and mediate all kinds of different, you know, physiological and behavioral functions. They're not there to mediate the effects of heroin. These drugs simply, by chance, have a chemical structure that allow them to tap into these endogenous systems. Now, one thing that endogenous opiate systems in the brain are involved in is that they mediate a lot of what my colleague Kent Berridge calls liking reactions. They're very much involved in mediating the subjective pleasurable effects that are associated, again, normally with natural rewards, but also the pleasurable effects associated with drugs like heroin.
Okay.
But they mediate, opiate systems in the brain are involved in mediating stress. They're involved in mediating pain.
Okay. So, I mean, there's a whole range.
There's a
of
whole
these.
Range of.
Do we know
brain
all of
system.
Them now, or tomorrow if we pick up science and say, "Ah, they've discovered a new naturally occurring opiate that does da da da."
Well, when endogenous opiate systems in the brain were discovered about 20 years ago, I mean, they were only really discovered about 20 years ago. We knew that opiate drugs like heroin and morphine acted on brain receptors, but they weren't identified. No one knew what they were. No one knew what the endogenous transmitter was. They were discovered about 20 years ago, and at that time, it was like every other week a new receptor was discovered. So,
what about combat fatigue? Do we know anything about that that helps?
Yeah. There's a lot of research going on with post-traumatic stress, and it actually overlaps to some extent with the kinds of systems that I'm talking about that drugs of abuse act on. You can also think of post-traumatic stress to some extent in the same kind of vein I talked about when I talked about if you're exposed to drugs, it sensitizes brain systems very, very persistently. Well, another kind of event that sensitizes these same brain systems is traumatic stress. And so, in fact, if you expose animals to repeated intermittent stress, they will later on in their life be hypersensitive to drugs. Or if you give them repeated drugs, they'll be hypersensitive to stressors. So there's a lot of overlap in these brain systems. And so there's a lot of research going on trying to understand how these kinds of brain systems are changed as a consequence of that experience. And another feature is also related to drugs of abuse, is why they change in some people but not others. That is, there's a lot of individual variation. And in fact, both in susceptibility to develop these sensitizing effects of drugs of abuse and individual variation in the susceptibility to develop things like post-traumatic stress. And so one goal of the research is to try to understand why some individuals are so susceptible, that is, their brain systems are so susceptible to undergo these kinds of changes versus others are not.
But it's interesting. One case, you're taking some chemical from the outside, but in this case of stress, it's creating it inside.
One thing that all drugs of abuse have in common is they massively activate this brain dopamine system that I talked about. But environmental stimuli can do the same thing. Stress also produces a massive activation of this system. And when you produce a massive activation of this system, you tend to change it. Now, of course, they're not the same thing exactly, but there are commonalities. And one goal of a lot of the research is to understand the commonalities, the differences, and how brain systems undergo this kind of plasticity to lead to psychopathology.
I mean, this brings up a whole range of interesting things, and you can sort of begin to think into the science fiction of this. And it's not so much fiction anymore, because we've heard in the last weeks that we can now take a stem cell and produce an egg. You can put your own genetic material into that and therefore begin to generate clones and things of this nature. I mean, it's not so difficult anymore to imagine. So now talk a little bit then about the genetics of some of this, because, you know, this post-traumatic syndrome you were talking about, some people suffer, others don't. So a military-industrial complex might say, hey, let's just find out what the genetic part is that doesn't.
Superman. And
something along those lines. You know, fine, well, in AIDS, I mean, it was some of these prostitutes in Nairobi that were sort of totally immune to AIDS. No matter how many times they had unprotected sex, they never actually got the disease. So a little bit then where we are in terms of understanding genetics, temptation, addiction.
Yeah, so one thing that we're working on a lot in my lab right now is individual variation in what I'll call The propensity to attribute motivational value to cues, in particular cues that have been associated with drugs. And what we find is that some individuals are very prone not only to undergo sensitization, but to attribute motivational value to cues, and as a consequence, have a lot of trouble resisting these kinds of temptations. Now, this is a very complex psychological trait, if you will, that is the propensity to attribute motivational value to cues, and it's clearly due to partly genetic kinds of factors, although we know nothing about the genetic determinants at this point, but we have evidence to show that it's heritable kind of trait. But with any psychological, complex psychological trait, none of them are due solely to genetic factors or solely to environmental factors. These kinds of things are all due to gene-environment interactions. And so one goal of our research is to understand what kinds of genetic factors interact with what kinds of environmental factors to yield these individuals susceptible and
that's
have problems resisting temptation, if you
in.
Will.
That's yeah. a lot of variables.
A lot
there.
Of variables.
What have you found so far?
Well, in terms of genetic determinants, we haven't found anything so far. We're just really starting down that road to try to get genetic markers for this particular susceptibility trait. We know a little bit about environmental variables because we know that if we raise animals either in an enriched environment or an environment where they've had early life adversity, we can shift this trait to one direction or the other. And so there's clearly an environmental factor that's involved.
Hang on.
That's,
so what you mean is if by a rich environment, many different types of stimulation, so for in terms of people, lots of reading, lots of music, lots of hiking, lots of sport, this would produce someone less prone to susceptibility?
Yeah. So in the rat model, what it is sort of isolated or housed in a regular cage, maybe with another rat, but with nothing else in terms of enriched environment. The enriched environment is like a condo with toys and yeah. and tunnels and all kinds of stuff. And indeed, animals raised in that complex environment are less susceptible to attribute motivational value to cues in the sense that they can resist the temptation, if you will, to a greater extent than others.
Well, so, I mean, that's a really interesting. I've always wanted to do experiments with rats and music. I happen to like
There are studies where they can be trained by cues to do something.
Oh, yeah. Rats are very sensitive to cues in the environment, particularly cues that predict either adverse consequences or positive outcomes and are very, very quick, like any other organisms, to learn about the relationship between things that are advantageous to them versus things that are disadvantageous. And that kind of learning in the literature is known as either Pavlovian conditioning or instrumental conditioning.
And are people just as clever? We think we're cleverer than – we know all about Pavlov. We know about Skinner. Yeah, and therefore we think we can beat that on.
Yeah, we think we're clever, but right. We're not. We're just as susceptible to these basic kinds of psychological functions.
Okay. Well, just 5 years from now, what do you think you and your group are going to know that's key that we don't know today?
Well, what we hope to know is actually the topic that you touched on just a minute ago, which is really to try to understand the genetic and environmental determinants of susceptibility to attribute motivational or really pathological motivational value to drug cues.
And so, therefore, would you recommend in 10 years we all go and get our DNA genome really well established? Would that be even useful?
We will see.
Great. We will see. And we will be back next week. Terry Robinson, Professor of Neuroscience and Psychology, University of Michigan. It's great fun having you on Science Studio. Thanks
for having
here.
Me. I enjoyed it very much.
Yes, thanks very much. Really fascinating things that's making us think and react to our cues. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And you'll be back next week, another Science Studio. You're cued into that. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.